Wednesday, September 28, 2022. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado. And we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. You're getting to that halfway point. You're halfway through your work week. I hope that your week is going well. Hope you, your family, your friends, everyone is staying healthy in your world right now. And you know, we have so much going on in the world of sports right now. I mean, think about it. Major League Baseball is in the final stretch. And hey, that NL East is coming down to the wire between the Atlanta Braves and the New York Mets. We've got Aaron Judge and Albert Pujols out there in historic runs right now. Plus, it was another wild weekend in both college football and in the NFL. Over in college football, rough weekend for Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. They were all upset. That part of the country probably not the happiest right now. And then over in the NFL, it was also insane. Because we say it all the time, but how in the world can you possibly predict the NFL in any way? This week, we saw more upsets, more surprises, more wild finishes. Something to think about. There are now, in the National Football League, just two undefeated teams. Okay. I mean, shows a little bit of parity, but who had Philadelphia and Miami being the two undefeated teams? Yeah, no one. That's who. Think about this over the weekend. Matt Ryan somehow beat Patrick Mahomes. Tua Tagovailoa somehow beat Josh Allen. And Trevor Lawrence absolutely crushed Justin Herbert. The AFC South went 3-0 against the AFC West. Are the Jacksonville Jaguars actually a solid team? I'm not sure. Are the Los Angeles Chargers and the New England Patriots in trouble? They might be. Are my Denver Broncos going to keep winning ugly, or will they lose this next week to the winless Las Vegas Raiders? Yeah, I know. I'm probably picking the Raiders on that one too. Hey, we may not know what is going to happen next in the NFL, but at least this week they did announce they are getting rid of that awful Pro Bowl. And I don't care who you cheer for. I don't care if you're a Bears fan, if you're a Packers fan, if you're a Cowboys fan, it doesn't matter. I think we can all agree that Pro Bowl was an absolute mess, and it is absolute good riddance to it. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, make sure you're swinging by DailyDoseSports.com every week. We have new articles going up every week. I put a new article up on Tuesdays. Young Jimmy will put an article up on Thursdays about a number of different subjects, but we've also got links to the podcast. We've got links to the video. We've got links to the Daily Dose gear. So if you need a t-shirt, you need a sweatshirt, it's starting to get cooler. You might need a hoodie. And why wouldn't you get a Daily Dose hoodie? It's going to be a little bit better than anything else. Anyways, so make sure you stop by DailyDoseSports.com and check out what we have going on over there. Hey, today on the show, I've got a guest that, trust me, you do not want to miss. Because this is a guy that knows sports. He knows business. He even knows music, and he has interviewed a number of very famous personalities, and he has a book out that you really need to check out. So right now, let's get over to our interview with author Andy Fry. Joining us today on the Daily Dose, we have a guest that, I'll be very honest, I personally cannot wait to speak with, because Andy Fry is a sports writer who has written for ESPN, but he's also written for Rolling Stone magazine. He currently writes for Forbes magazine. He's written for a lot of different publications. He also recently published a book called 90 Days in the 90s, which looks back at some culture. It looks back at some music, at some sports from the 90s. Over his career, Andy has interviewed hundreds of professional athletes, but I'm talking big time athletes, people like Shaquille O'Neal, Tom Brady, David Robinson, Mia Hamm, Billie Jean King, as well as musical artists like Smashing Pumpkins, Oasis, Morrissey, Jimmy Eat World, Rage Against the Machine, Alice in Chains. My goodness. I have so many things I want to ask Andy about today. Andy Fry, welcome to the Daily Dose. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
Andy, first off, I just kind of want to get some background on you. Where did you grow up? Where are you from? Kind of growing up wise, where were you from?
Well, so I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. I graduated high school in 1990 and went to college. And I actually have lived in Chicago on the north side since 94. So I've been here now. I just turned 50, a little bit over half my life. So, I like my dad's from Ohio. I got some family from Philly too. And like my dad's actually a pretty avid watcher of Ohio State football now, but he was never into sports growing up, strangely, although he, you know, like most men who are of the end of the silent generation, beginning of the baby boomers generation, like knew all about sports and, you know, it's just a manly thing to do. So I played football as a kid, started writing when I was in probably fourth grade. The first, you know, article, if you want to call it that, was, I think we had a blizzard in fourth grade. This is probably the winter of 82. I want to say it was the first time the Bengals and the 49ers went to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And other than that, there's just like, it was 20 degrees out. It was snow. It was games inside. And all of a sudden my little elementary school, just the fourth graders and third graders got just completely hooked on chess. Like we just were living, breathing chess. I don't know what happened one day. And I was diehard into it too. And we had a school newspaper called the Blair Mill Beagle. And I don't know if someone asked me or if I volunteered, but I wrote an article about our big, you know, raging obsession with chess.
Sure.
I think the article was called Chess Champs. And I covered like who was the best player, who's the second player, who's going to meet, you know, just, you know, like writing like a fourth grader thinking, oh, I'm writing my first sports article. And, you know, I've had lots of jobs in business and I was in sales for a long time, but I always came back to writing as a hobby and then just kind of started doing it a little bit over 10 years ago after being here in Chicago and being surrounded by sports and, but always remembering like, just like the little league games and the high school games and all the stuff that, you know, kind of camps itself in our minds that maybe nobody else cares about, but you know, the good times we have in sports that really get the wheels turning and make us love it, you know, for our whole life. So yeah, I mean, grew up in the East Coast, been in Chicago in the city the whole time and probably won't ever leave at this point, but probably try to make sports, you know, wherever I go, I either end up spending too much on sportswear or going to see a game or, you know, sometimes I go to these sports trips for golf and race car driving, get to interview somebody and, you know, but at the same time, like, I don't want anybody to think that I've got entry to the Super Bowl or I can just walk into Wrigley anytime I want. You know, I'm a freelancer, contract writer, kind of a lone hire, you know, kind of a lone gun, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But it's been great because I get to do a lot of what I want and just do a lot of cool things.
So you mentioned that you kind of grew up in the Philly area.
Yeah.
Were those the teams then that you kind of grew up rooting for? Were teams from back that way? Or did you transfer when you moved to Chicago? Did you end up cheering for Chicago teams? Who are the teams that you grew up kind of following? I mean, the players even?
Yeah, I would say, now with baseball, you know, I'm more of a Cubs fan than anything. And there's a culture behind that I can talk about. But growing up, it was, you know, the Sixers, like Dr. J was one of our heroes. So I got to interview as an adult a couple years ago. Phillies, I guess probably like I always have the strange fetishes baseball goes with like relief pitchers and closers. And I like Mike Schmidt was great. They're not really like an awesome personality. I'm not really a huge fan of Pete Rose personally, but he was, you know, he was animated to watch. And you know, I like the Gary Maddoxes and the Von Hayeses and the just kind of like the peripheral players who would come up big. That came, you know, some came and went, you know, like Von De Jesus and so on. Eagles, you know, were great. We got to the Super Bowl 15 and then got our clock cleaned by the Raiders.
Yeah.
But that's part of, you know, being a sports fan. And other than that, I picked up soccer in high school and probably because they knew I wasn't big enough to play football. And I'm probably a lot better at soccer now that I'm 50 than I was when I was 16 or 17. But I grew a passion around that. And just, you know, eventually when you were able to watch, you know, like English league games on TV, I'm talking like, you know, online in 1996 and having to pay $20 to go to a pub to see a Man United game or whatever, got really hooked on that. So, I mean, I've, you know, I used to be a diehard NBA fan, like lived and breathed it, college basketball even more, you know, strangely growing up in Eastern Pennsylvania, was never a Penn State fan. I think it's come. I think a lot of that is because my family's from Ohio. But I am a lifelong Villanova fan. On the other side of the screen, there's all kinds of Villanova stuff on my wall.
Okay.
Every time they win the championship, like, it's a big deal. I will go to the bar by myself, as I did to see them beat Michigan a couple years ago, and seen them nearly beat North Carolina and all that stuff. And but we have our teams, and sometimes they're not exactly, I don't live in Philadelphia. I haven't lived in Pennsylvania since the 90s. But I don't, it's with college football here, I haven't really completely 100% latched on, even though most of my family is Ohio State fans, and they try to drag me into it. And I watch a little bit, but,
right.
Some of it may be predicated on where my 16-year-old goes to college in a couple of years.
It will affect you big time. You can see a CSU pennant back behind me. My son goes to CSU. I think my daughter's going to end up going to CSU. I'm not a CSU fan, but all my money goes there, so I guess I got to be a fan now.
I have a good friend there. My friend Tammy Matthews taught there for a while, and actually had, spoke to some students there several years ago about – it ended up being a conversation about writing sports writing in the gig economy, because they all knew that I was, a freelancer. So what's it like to be, a gig sports writer and not in-house at Sports Illustrated? I think they would, it's maybe a generational thing that they kind of see opportunities differently. But yeah, I thought, here's my big pointed opinion. I think Fort Collins is way cooler than Boulder. I mean, it kills it.
Preaching to the choir, baby. I could not agree more. It's a beautiful kind of small town feel, as opposed to the overgrown, overcrowded, overpriced area of Boulder. Could not agree more. It's funny because you mentioned a few things there. You spoke about Dr. J. Dr. J, to me, growing up here with the Nuggets, Dr. J was the first real superstar that I remember. Obviously, we had David Thompson, Issel, whatever. But I would tune in to watch Dr. J. And you talked about periphery kind of players. I kept being drawn to Andrew Toney and going, oh, that guy, that's the guy I want to play like. I want to play like Andrew Toney. I wore number 22 in high school because of Andrew Toney. I'm not a Sixers guy, but just so good.
He's a periphery player because he got injured. I mean, there's all kinds of theories about that he might have been the first Jordan, because, he was a great shooting guard with great agility, and he was kind of cocky, and he could shoot the threes. But, he had a shortened career, so it's kind of like, maybe Mark Pryor would have been a Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cubs had he not thrown in a way that destroyed his elbow.
Right.
He can go down that road or, whatever. But, they were inspiring to watch. And strangely, the mouthpiece of that Sixers team was Moses Malone.
Yes, he was.
He was kind of reliable, but not the most exciting to watch. He was just a big center, grab the ball and kind of shake his elbows a little bit. But,
I'm glad
that you like him, too.
Well, same thing with Villanova. I was a huge Jay Wright fan, but even before that, with Raleigh's teams and the efficient way his teams played, the mistake-free, as a basketball coach, I had so much respect for the job that he did. The game that they beat Georgetown, and I know we look back and they had no business. They weren't scared of Georgetown. They played Georgetown all the time. That wasn't anything new to them. But the efficiency that team played with, how do you possibly shoot that well from the field and from the line? Just absolutely amazing. I can sit here and talk to you about those Villanova teams. I'm a huge Jay Wright fan. I'm genuinely sad that he stepped down, because the sport is going to miss one of the good guys that does things the right way, teaches kids the right way. All right, I'm going to change gears on you a little bit. I know this is going to be tough. You talked about your first article. You talked about writing it. Do you remember the first article that you actually got paid for? Do you remember what that would have been? Or even broad subject?
Probably, I think it was the first article I wrote for ESPN back in 2011. I had started blogging back around when everybody our age got on Facebook in about 2009. I actually started writing, as I've said to a couple podcasters I've talked to, I don't know if you remember Facebook notes, a lot of people would do things about me and, here's my five favorite foods. You tag all these friends and annoy the hell of them. They'd be like, copy and repaste. So I would do more about sports, and I would tag people that maybe I connected from college. I haven't seen them since college. Hey, remember this game? Or I do my top five sports moments nobody else remembers. And I would tag people and get some people to be like, oh yeah, I actually remember that. And I had a couple friends who said, you should start a blog. And I think I probably responded at the time, okay, I think I know what a blog is. It's kind of like a web page that I just set up, right? and did that for a while, and would just kind of, you know, post my stuff and kind of let people know I wrote things. And I would never check the analytics on it, because I didn't want it to figure in or disappoint me when 8 people read something I wrote, or only 12 people, because it didn't really matter. But I made a goal back in 2009 or 10. I said, you know, if I can get something published in the next 5 years, whether it's like a guest column of the Tribune in Chicago or like a local paper or, you know, whatever, you know, that would be a goal. And so I was in sales and business for a while. So I think you sink or swim when you're in a business environment. Long story short, you learn how to build relationships. So I was pretty good at not being afraid to reach out to editors and be like, hey, I know you do this page for ESPN, or I know that you cover, you know, like a baseball editor or whatever, and I would pitch stories and a lot of times get no. And the angle in for me was for my first article for ESPN in July of 2011 is I actually wrote something for Page Two. I don't know if you remember Page Two.
I do remember Page Two. Yeah.
Page Two was a lot of like pop culture related things and kind of strange sports. And, you know, like the video of the day would be something like some kid winning like the Kansas State Championship, hitting the last shot, you know, like a freshman hitting the last shot for his high school at the buzzer, winning the game. That was that kind of stuff that they would show. Sure. And they had, you know, it was owned by Disney. So, of course, like, hey, let's, you know, we own the Jonas Brothers. Let's have them hang out with LeBron for a day. We'll write an article about that. Like, so eventually they kind of came up with like, we need some more things, and none of their staffers are writing for them. So I pitched a couple things and got a couple polite no's. And the first thing I wrote about was a sport called fistball, which is kind of like a variant of volleyball, which is, it's played in Scandinavia and Germany, South Africa, Brazil. And then there was this ragtag team in the US and Wisconsin with a couple of, you know, it's kind of considered a German sport in origin. So there's like a German American club in Wisconsin, literally, that would play, have been playing fistball since the 50s. Never heard of it. I don't even remember how I got the tip about it, but it was kind of offbeat enough. And also that there was a World Cup, so it was legitimate enough. There's like, yeah, Here's a sport you've heard of. Here's Team USA. There's a World Cup. They're going to the Fistball World Cup in Austria this summer. So I contacted the, just give me a backstory. I contacted like the U.S. Fistball Association president.
Wow.
He has like a day job. He's like the fleet manager of the Park District somewhere up in Wisconsin, but loves fistball. Wanted to talk about it all day. Was so excited I was coming up. Told me the players to talk to. I shot some video. And yeah, I mean, it was just enough that I got an article in ESPN. I submitted to him, and I thought like I thought I was going to get blown off, because the editor of the book kind of had a reputation for being a little douchey. I'm not going to say his name, but yeah, eventually when it was posted, I was at the Phillies Cubs game with another, you know, freelance writer friend of mine who had done some stuff, and I just checked my, I don't know, I think I finally checked my email, and it came through like, oh, I think I got published, like. And I got paid something like $175 for 387 words and 2 videos. I think they're supposed to pay me per video, and they only pay me for one or something. But
of course,
yeah.
They did.
So I told all my friends, I'm like, there's the ESPN logo, my name's under, and I wrote an article, and that was great. You know, I thought that maybe I kind of had thought that I'm never going to write for them again. It's just like a one shot deal,
right?
But my sort of sales mind and my relationship building and knowing how to like follow up, and I just kind of like kept looking for little opportunities. And then the next thing was covering, back when ESPN Chicago had a prep blog, I covered high school football, like Southside Catholic League football.
Oh yeah.
All of 2011 at a game every week. And then like, when you've done that, it doesn't matter whether you went to journalism school or not, because I didn't. You have a track record, and you just kind of, you know, if you're a little bit fearless, you just kind of pitch what you've done and you look for other opportunities. So I made kind of like, it's like the old video game Frogger, where you hop from like leaf to leaf or whatever.
Right, like, right.
Just looking for opportunities. And I never took it for granted. I never thought that, oh, I'm going to wait for them to hire me as a staffer. I'm going to demand this. Like, I never expected, you know, down the road to be emailing someone to request an interview with Johnny Bench and then having them say yes. And I could talk about that. But I mean, that's really how it was. It wasn't like, I don't have connections, I'm not related to anybody important, I don't have a journalism degree from Syracuse. It was just kind of following through on what I wanted to do, and if it meant getting paid $50 a game or $300 for this one thing, and that's all I did in 1 month, and you know, that I kept on top of it, and I didn't quit my day job, I didn't get discouraged about, you know, not having what someone else does. It was just a lot of little opportunities that have kind of snowballed now to like a pretty respectable list of pro athletes I've gotten to interview.
really good list of athletes that you've interviewed. But, you know, we talked about a little bit before, and I asked you about some of your favorite teams, some of your favorite athletes growing up. Yeah. You've also kind of delved over into the music scene. You've kind of you've interviewed a number of big time musical acts. What about your favorite musical artists? Who are the artists that you as a kid were you know, growing up listening to and going, man, someday I want to talk to somebody like that?
Well, I didn't have the same perspective on that. I mean, I grew up in the late 80s, graduated in 1990, when 1990 was a strange music year. I've been on a bunch of
really
music
was
podcasts. Like, we think of the 90s as like Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins, and I love all them. Strangely, like, 1990 as a year was like Adam Ant has his comeback album. Sinead O'Connor is the biggest singer-songwriter in the world for a certain amount of time. Probably the two biggest like hard rock bands were Jane's Addiction, who they're great, but they've only put out like three studio albums now, even.
Yeah.
And Living Color. And then we had like these strange bands like the Soup Dragons that were on MTV. So it was like, that was before the switch flicked in. It was Nirvana, grunge, you know, Bye Bye Amy Grant and Debbie Gibson. Everything's alternative and indie now. And
yeah,
all artists that play their own instruments and write their own songs and come from small labels. So I didn't really have that perspective, but I loved Husker Du. So I often knew Bob Mould. Bob Mould was in Sugar. Some people don't know Husker Du necessarily. Love the Smiths, and then Public Enemy was probably the other one.
Okay.
I got to meet Chuck D like in 1996. I just went to a book signing of his.
How was that?
Cool. Like, he's really friendly. You expect to be like all militant and stuff, but we were probably like 30 people in this tiny ass bookstore at DePaul University. And, you know, he shook everyone's hands, said hello. He just kind of treats it like a town hall.
Okay.
Talk about, like, you know, not like I'm going to read from my book, buy it. It's more like, let's talk about some things going on in the world.
Yeah.
So,
is there a better voice to talk about what's going on in the world than Chuck D?
He's one of the best. I mean, he's one of the better ones. I don't agree with all of maybe what he. I'm pretty socially liberal, but I think he's a little hard on Biden. You know, we don't have to get into politics now, but I mean, those guys are always like, there's always bad stuff going on in the world, and there's always stuff you need to improve on. They're not going to kind of say, well, things are pretty good. Like, this is the Clinton years, and he wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
So he had some things to complain about then, and that's just kind of how they are. They're kind of like revolutionary poets. But what I was going to say was, like, when I was at doing the after the football thing in ESPN, the way that I got to interview rock stars, the way that it all started actually was I was blogging for a site that was owned by the Tribune, and I think an email or post went up about this. It's like Billy from Smashing Pumpkins is starting a wrestling league, and the community manager is like, don't email me, but if you want to try to get an interview, here's his PR person. Okay. So like I read that within 20 minutes, I'm crafting my mind, like, you know, subject line of my email is going to have ESPN. It's going to be a short, I always say, write pitches that are 150 words or less, straight to the point. Got an email the next day. By the time maybe 1 o'clock PM rolled around the following day, I had a booked interview with Billy to talk about wrestling. And, you know, I was instructed like what not to talk about and what not to ask him about. And I got to get credentials from my editor and stuff like that. But it was pretty exciting. I was like, I'm going to talk to like a legit rock star.
Yeah.
And I've interviewed him a couple times. It's been a few years, but the second time was around when Oceania's 2013 album came up, and he had warmed up a little bit by then. And I got to meet him in person once or twice with the whole wrestling thing, which was kind of fun. And he's back into, I think he's got a new wrestling league that just literally popped up a couple weeks ago. He started talking.
Okay.
It's like NWA. I don't remember what NWA stands for. It's like New World Assembly. I don't know. But he's doing the wrestling thing again. But so then I kind of took that as an opportunity to be like, all right, I want to interview more aging rock stars about their sports hangups. And literally the next thing was I was about to turn 40. My birthday was coming up, and I thought, you know, no left Oasis. They broke up. He's doing his own band now. They might be interested in some press. So why don't I see if I can get an interview with him? Just like my birthday present myself in late March, April of 2012. And, you know, I didn't really know where to begin, but like, there's sort of an entrepreneurial mindset I think some of us freelance writers have, and that we know that no one, you know, I mean, sometimes people, editors will hand you a cool thing and say, go check this out. Can you want to do this?
Sure.
But other times it's, you got to kind of eat what you kill. And I think I knew that he was doing Coachella. I think they contacted them and they said, well, here's his press person in New York, contact them. And it was really the same thing. Like, are you for real? Who you write for? What do you want to talk about? And like, yeah, we think we can get you an interview if you're available this date and time. And they moved that like half a dozen times. But yeah, you know, that was actually the season that Man City won their first championship in this century.
Sure.
I think the day I talked to him, they were down 3-0 and then came back and tied Sunderland 3-3, if I remember right. So we were kind of talking about the game, but he had kind of written Man City off as, you know, his childhood club. He kind of written them off at that point. But we only talk about mostly about sports and talk about like how there's always sports stuff in his video, music videos, like one centers around boxing and one centers around skateboarding. And kind of, he didn't answer a lot of my questions, but gave me different answers that were interesting. So like, you know, the rock stars are kind of elusive. Like they're kind of guarded, but then when you talk to them about things that they want to talk about, like their favorite sports team or like Jerry Cantrell, big NFL fan.
Yeah.
You know, like just they just open up and they give you gifts and those sort of the things that are the great quotes in your, and just like getting to talk to them, provided you don't piss them off or something, is rewarding enough as it is. So
is there a athlete or musical artist that you have interviewed and just said, that was the best interview? I couldn't have asked for anything more. They answered everything. They gave me everything I wanted. And then some, is there someone out there that you're just like, oh, that was the funnest interview I've ever done?
I don't know. There's been probably at least a good dozen of those where, like Billie Jean King, when I talked to her again last week, she talks more than I do. So it's funny. I've interviewed her twice, and both times I'm on the Zoom and her press people are like, she needs to go now. And I'm like, I'm trying to, like, she's answering my question the long way. And
right.
She actually said the first time to her press people, they got on like, Billie, we need to like scoot. She's like, no, I'm talking here. So she was awesome. But you know, there's like David Robinson. Like I thought he was kind of like a straight laced vanilla dude. Like
yeah. He would
stats when he's playing, and he always crushed my teams. But he was cool to talk to. Probably the most interesting one where it was not what I thought, but turned out well, was I got to interview Morrissey, you know, from the Smiths.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, he's one of the few that I haven't. Most of the time I'll get like 15 minutes on the phone with somebody. I do a lot of email Q&As now, sometimes just convenience and location. But he was the first one where they said, well, he's not going to get on the phone with you. Email some questions. And I thought, again, I was going to get blown off. And with the exception of maybe one question, he didn't answer my questions, but he gave me some answers that then the article was about that. So it was like Morrissey being Moody, international sure. man of ministry, who I didn't know this, that he was, I guess in gym class in high school, he was actually pretty good at sports. And he was like the tall, skinny kid they'd pass the ball to when he'd put it in the back of the net. But of course, no one looks at him as like an athlete. They think he's a wuss.
Sure.
And then he got kind of competitive about it, at least during gym class. So from that, I think that informed some of his, at least he said, he kind of informed some of his lyrics to his songs, you know, that I think he called like the passion and, you know, he had all these elaborate ways of describing like the high stakes of being an athlete. You know, I guess he, like a poet would put themselves in the shoes of a ringmaster at the circus to write a good poem. He kind of did that with some of the songs, and again, didn't really answer my questions. And, but it turned out to be a fun article, and you know, it's because of about the questions he didn't answer, and it was fine, which is kind of how Morrissey really is. So
sure, I totally understand that. You don't have to name names. Is there an athlete? Is there a musical artist that you were like, they didn't give me anything? Like they just wouldn't give me.
I mean, Noel Gallagher was kind of like that a little bit, where I'm like, I you know, you like you got this video. He had this video. I don't remember the name of the song, where it's like a man and a woman are in a relationship. So Noel Gallagher's playing the referee and the woman is punching the guy in the face. And that's kind of representative, like their relationship.
Okay.
I said, do you watch boxing? He's like, no, not really. And it's like, well, how'd that video come about? Oh, I don't know. It was a good idea. But you know, we got him on. He started talking about the NFL. I was like, well, what do you think of American sports? Cause I know, you know, maybe you don't care, but like, you know, sports is huge. And he said, actually, like, I don't get any of your sports, but I freaking love the NFL. And he's basically, I think he led on that he was like, this is, you know, going back 10 years when if you were a rock star and you stay up till 4 a.m. in England, well, what's on TV? American football. And I think he got hooked that way.
Sure.
I don't know if he has a team that he picked now. He kind of strikes me as like a Steelers kind of a guy or something. Or maybe
yeah, I could see that.
Maybe like the Broncos or something. But yeah, he just kind of like same thing. You know, we just kind of kept it conversational. And the only, I mean, I haven't had anybody be a jerk. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Ash Barty, the tennis player just retired, the
yeah.
world number one. And with her, it was like, I think she's just kind of introverted, but she gave me like 15 times. It was like, yeah, I'd ask her a question about preparing for Wimbledon or the U.S. Open or Aussie Open. And she's like, I don't know. I don't really think about it. You know, like, how do you get to be so good at tennis? Like, I don't know. I don't really think about it. You just do it. Like, she gave me that. And when you get that sometimes as a sports writer, like, okay, thanks a lot, dude. Like, all right, I guess I'll write about your achievements now. But
right.
But then, like, Venus Williams, who's supposed to be really introverted and guarded, who, she gets asked a million stupid questions about stuff that has nothing to do with tennis.
Sure, she does.
I actually kind of, like, joked about that. She's like, yeah, you know, that's the way it is, unfortunately. And she opened up and talked about her creative pursuit. Yeah, at the same time, like, I would say, like, who's your biggest rival or who have you had the biggest rivalry? And if you're going to talk to, obviously, Chris Evert, she's going to say Martina.
Right.
You're going to talk to, I don't know, Jennifer Capriati, she's going to say Monica Seles. But Venus is like, whoever's on the other side of the net, which isn't a great answer for a writer like me. But, you know, you just got to write what they say and kind of roll with it. So there's been nothing bad. Nobody's been a jerk. But I also don't approach it like, I think about the sportscasters I don't like Jim Gray, sticking a mic in people's face, asking them pointed questions.
Yeah.
A zinger. And I never approach it that way. I just treat them like people. And I'm interested to know, you know, what kind of pushes their buttons. And I think I ask open-ended questions. Maybe it's the sales and business background of mine. I think that serves me well. And then, you know, you treat them like people, they act like people. You're respectful, they're respectful back. And, you know, when someone like Tom Brady says my name in an interview, you're like, well, Andy, let me tell you, it's kind of surreal, but
yeah.
Sometimes they're just people too. So,
Andy, you now write for Forbes magazine. Yeah. You write quite a bit about the business side of sports.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the business side of sports changing constantly. We're seeing it really, really prevalent right now in college football, college sports in general with the NIL stuff. We're seeing schools jump conference to conference trying to pull the most money. We know they can pretend it's this or that. It's business. It's money. They want to make more of it. We're just headed toward a minor league system, I think, in collegiate sports in general, aren't we?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I do think that the NIL, you know, we could argue about it, debate about it. I think that when athletes get a full ride to a good university or you just get tuition paid for, that's kind of a, you know, a trade for not getting a salary. So I wouldn't agree with, like, Chuck D, for example, would say, like, they should get a salary. I don't know that I agree with that, but I'm glad that now, if Michigan State's going to sell, you know, let's say they got a quarterback that's really great and, you know, they sell the jersey with his name and number on the back of it, that he gets paid on that. It's not just they get to keep all the money. So I think we're in a pretty good middle ground where individual athletes who really do shine are getting a piece of the pie. And then, you know, kind of encourages them, I think, to see the opportunity for how they can grow, you know, whether someone goes and has a Hall of Fame career or not. I think about the fact that, you know, when you and I were growing up in the 80s, they kind of made fun of this in Jerry Maguire, where Cuba Gooding Jr. is on the Camel doing like a bed commercial or something like that. Like, that was what it was. Like, you got paid $15,000 a day to show up and do this one thing, and that was it. Whereas now, as a matter of practice, you're seeing not just, you know, you're definitely, I talked to a lot of retired sports legends, you know, Greg Norman and Ryan Howard and, you know, even Tom Brady on his brand, where they have an equity stake in their brand, they have a little bit of say. You know, maybe they hire a designer to design their shoe or their shirts, and they know that the designer is the designer, and they have ideas that they can talk about. But, you know, you're hiring a person to kind of do the job, you know, to the expert to do the expert part of what you're producing. But that they have an equity stake, and they want to grow the business, not just get paid once. And you're seeing young athletes, like, I've got to email some questions to Shaquille O'Neal's two sons are in a partnership that's coming out with some shoe company. I don't remember the details of it, but I got to get through it. So, like, they're not, you know, obviously they're not the big name that Shaq is. It's not an endorsement thing, but they're starting a business and a brand where they're really involved in it. And, you know, they have a stake in it. So they have an interest in not just collecting paycheck, but growing with it and, you know, tending to it. And I think that's a completely different. It works both ways, where I think if the athletes are engaged in a business venture, that they get more out of it. And also that you're not just having corporate entities just, you know, throw money at somebody for a one-time deal and then they don't get anything out of it. So I think the symbiosis is there. It's a little bit more of a just a holistic approach to using sports, which people are going to continue to love sports and follow sports, so that everybody can get paid and there's more value from all sides of it. So, I mean, that's kind of what I write about when I interview. I got to interview Tom Brady back in January. You know, I kind of asked him, like, I'm assuming that you were in some sort of system. You're the greatest quarterback of all time, but you were in Belichick's system. Now you're in the Brady brand system. You got guys you know more about design and finance than you do. How do you be coachable with that? How do you engage that and, you know, not jump over your skis and not try to, you know, like, how do you be a partner in that and an employee in it, not just, you know, collecting a check or telling people what to do? And that works its way down to, you know, lesser known athletes. Lindsey Vonn's doing a ton of stuff with different brands where she consults on design, or she's a little bit quiet about some of the things she do, but I know she's on some executive boards. I think she does some like investment stuff that she's not really divulging now, but like she's involved in a lot of different things. It's not just, you know, Lindsey Vonn on a L'Oreal commercial looking pretty. I mean, there's like, right, she's involved in business and she's going to be for a while, and she's smart and aggressive and engaging, and, you know, it's propagating its way through everything that she's doing now that she's retired from her skis. So
that's kind of what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that we see these kids make this a career money situation, not just a, like you said, got money thrown at me for 4 years while I was in college or whatever, blew that, it's gone. Now what? I'm hoping that we're going to see more situations like that where these kids get the opportunity to really make a change in what they're doing. One other situation in the business of sports, we're seeing the NFL is making that jump to Amazon streaming, and the numbers came out this week. That week one game from the Chiefs and the Chargers pulled 13 million viewers for a Thursday night game on a streaming platform. Same thing. It sure looks like we're going to be heading to that streaming platform, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that. It is probably good that they tested with that, because Thursday night football has been kind of a dog, and there's been talk in the past years about why even do it. I mean, I'm a bit of a cynic when it comes to the NFL because I'm not a huge football fan. So it's like Monday night football, Thursday night football. All Friday night is going to be, you know, the Gramblings and the Akrons, and then all day Saturday is the big teams, and then your Sunday football all day is NFL, and then it starts over Monday. And then we've seen these sports, these football leagues in the spring, like the, I don't know, what was it, the AFF?
Yes, and USFL. You know,
NFL, I don't think, I think it's kind of, so it's good to see that the NFL is testing something different. They're taking a portion of their offering and treating it differently. Like, you know, I think about, again, 80s. I remember there was a time where GM, all the, not to get too businessy on you, but, you know, Cadillac, Pontiac, Buick, Chevy, they all had a model that across the board, they looked the same. They all had their mid-sized car that basically looked like the Cadillac version, which is maybe $2,000 more, and the Buick, which had a different, and it's like, why do that? So they're kind of looking at their different segments and thinking, well, Let's take the one that's kind of failing a little bit and maybe make it, spin it up and make it a different offering. I don't know, maybe it'll be mobile only. That could be interesting if it succeeds as mobile only. So the people who are, you know, I think we all, the football fans who are diehards, you know, they set aside time on Sunday and college football on Saturday. They don't really, our behavior is not really the same on Thursday nights, I don't think. And you're competing with, I don't even know what's on, you know, back in the 90s, it was Seinfeld.
Cheers. Yeah.
Cheers. That's like a big decision. So why not make it different? And that's about all I know about that. I'm just fascinated to see it's now a different project. And it's a different approach with something that was, you know, 2 years ago talked about maybe getting rid of Thursday night football. So it's cool to see. Yeah. It's repurposed differently. It's a whole new thing.
Yeah, it is. And it looks like it's headed that direction. I'm a little worried that all sports are going to kind of head in that streaming direction, but I'm hoping that's not the case. No, you don't think so?
No.
That encourages me.
Yeah. And the TV's not going away, just like the book isn't going away. I mean, I've had people bugging me about, hey, when are you going to do an audio version of my book? And I'm like, well, of the 9 people who would buy it nationally, I'm not really sure that I'm going to spend the money to do that. You know, I keep hearing I have to do it because, you know, it's the new thing, but, you know, I don't own any crypto and my investments are fine. I'm going to be able to retire on time, I think.
Right.
So I don't need to, like, you know, or I was a Racky Dinars back 15 years ago. And there's always something that is new that is worth a look, but, you know, it's not for everybody. I think the media landscape is too big and regimented. The TVs aren't going to go away anytime soon. And there's only so much you could do looking on a small screen. Like, I like looking at my phone for some things, and then it starts to hurt my face.
Maybe no, you're right.
Generational thing, but, you know, it's I don't see the TV going away. So anyway, that's my debate point there.
I'm encouraged by that. I hope you're absolutely correct. Andy, let's get to the good stuff, because if you're watching the video, you can see over your shoulder, you have a book out right now that you have written called 90 Days in the 90s. And I'm going to be honest, it covers something that I think about like every single day, going back in time to a better time. Your main character goes back to the mid 90s in Chicago, which again, yeah. I love, because especially right now, I feel like I want to go back in time every single day. But your book dives into, like I said, music, culture, sports, which really gives the reader like such a fun trip into thinking about one specific thing. If you could go back, what would you do?
Yeah.
If I pose that question to you, there's a million different ways you can go. What are you doing
if
you
go back? Think about the 90s, and I'll pick two of the better movies from the 90s. There is Pulp Fiction and Dazed and Confused. And Days Confused was kind of more of a cult classic, like nobody knew who the hell Ben Affleck and Matthew McConaughey were in 1991 or whenever it came out. Pulp Fiction was like, okay, John Travolta's got a career.
Right.
Samuel L. Jackson, oh, that guy from, you mean the robber from...
Coming to America.
Please refrain from using any further obscenities in the presence of these people.
What?
I've warned you. I'll be forced to thrash you.
Yeah, that's what it was in 1994. But I pick those two movies because... both of those movies happen over a span of one day, and you are following along with the people. So when you're riding in the car where, you know, the guy in the back gets his face blown off accidentally by John Travolta's character, like you feel like you're there, like you feel like you're covered in the blood and the brains and all that fun stuff. And you could argue that maybe there's not really a salient plot in Dazed Confused, and something like that shouldn't have been made into a movie, but I mean, it's a classic, and our generation loves it. And now there's an annual fest where they show it in Austin once a year. It's like one of the prides of Austin. And it's cool to go back and see like these people won Oscars and been nominated for Oscars, like Affleck and McConaughey, and like Parker Posey's been in a million really good indie movies. So I kind of thought, I think in the back, I didn't know that this was going to happen when I was starting to write a book. I just had an idea. I'm a huge music fan. I have a bunch of 90s playlists. And I think I was just walking around one day about 5 years ago saying, like, what would you like to, if I could time travel back to, you know, what I'm listening to right now? Like, what would that look like? And as a writer, I think a lot of writers, if you stick with it, it's like you're told by friends you should write a book, or you think you have a book in you. Or for, I think in my case, I just wanted to see if I could pull off writing a book and actually finish the damn thing and like start something and not give up whether anybody bought it or read it. So I kind of took those two things, the sort of like this cinematic, experiential approach to what I remember in the 90s, which was, okay, I was never a gangster, but I could kind of see Pulp Fiction. I kind of experienced that for a day. It felt real. And
yeah,
I've been with enough stoners that Dazed Confused was kind of second nature to me. That
perfect.
You know, what do you talk about? You talk about stuff. You talk about movie pilots and music and the time this happened and who you dated. And a lot of that stuff I was able to filter through. I've done improv for years in Chicago. It's a very Chicago thing. Did it enough where I got to perform at Second City and produce a group. Me and a bunch of millennials, we did this group called the Disappointments. They're kind of like dry humor. We did pretty much like did it up to the when the pandemic kicked in. Second City, not main stage, but it's Skybox. And so with improv, you learn how to take what you want to talk about and make real dialogue of it, because you know, a bad scene is you and me sitting there saying, what are we talking about? What are we doing? Yeah. Like, that's boring. So that, you know, I think I just kind of played with it and wrote a bunch of drafts and eventually hired an editor to kind of help tell me things I didn't want to hear. Like, you need to pare this down, or this conversation is interesting, but it's kind of taking you away from the plot, like keep the plot going. And then you kind of see it's like, you know, watching a movie. Like if you're watching Die Hard, which is a great late 80s movie, and you don't have constraints like Hans Gruber is going to blow up the building within the next 12 hours. And you need the hero to fix the problem in the next 12 hours.
Right.
Like if there's no time constraints and there's no peril, then your story's not really going to work. And people are just going to go, oh, yeah, I'm going to leave the building now. Like, sure. You know, whatever. So you learn all those things organically by writing. I didn't know how at first I was going to get all the music in, because you feel like you're just name dropping bands and kind of talk about times that you were, for me, it was times that I was at Lounge Axe or Double Door seeing this band that was legendary that, you know, the venue's not there anymore. But just kind of worked through it. I kept it kind of conversational. I thought about, like, literally if I went back in time and I wasn't in the time travel genre where, like, you got to save the world or you got to kill Hitler or whatever,
right,
what would I do? Well, I'd probably go back to a club to see the show. I'd go to a sandwich shop that I love that doesn't, you know, a burrito place that isn't open anymore that had the best burritos. Sure. And just kind of walk around for a day. And then if you really are stuck in the past, you're back in the 90s, if you could do that, you're like, oh, well, I got to figure out what I'm doing now. Do I get an apartment or get my job back or what? And those things happen sort of organically for Darby, my main character. I can tell you more about it, but basically she goes back to Chicago in 1996, the day that she moved away to New York. So it solves one problem that her friends don't know that she left, because like, oh, you didn't move to New York, did you? And she kind of resumes her life back where it was supposed to take place. And some things fall into place that she didn't know, you know, had she stuck around, these great things would happen. And other things happen that really bring to the forefront the fact that, you know, we can think about how great the past was, but we forget about how imperfect it was. And,
yeah,
you know, she has to deal with that too. So, yeah, dealt with a lot of themes, but for me, it was a fun thing to have a place back in the 1990s that I could go every day as I was writing, like, to hang out with these people and hang out with the music. And that's what made it kind of not easy, but just easier to, like, it wasn't just, I got to write, you know, 4,000 words this week to complete this chapter. It was like, I'm going to go hang out at Lounge Axe and I'm going to go to a poetry slam with these characters and let's see what happens.
Sure. Well, and with this going back to the 90s, and we talked about it a little bit before, but we were coming out of such a kind of weird era. We had that hair metal, we had everything just over the top and crazy. And then we got into that kind of weird 88, 89, 90, where it was just kind of weird. You kind of spoke to that. The 90s, once it really hit, and you had the grunge scene taking place in Seattle, you had the Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, you had those bands. But then you also had the really cool, you know, hip hop and rap kind of stuff. You've got a Tribe Called Quest back behind you. You had Destiny's Child, you had Tupac and Snoop and Biggie and so many acts coming out. It was this cool melting. Yeah. We had MTV. And I know that kids today tell us another story, Grandpa, but MTV actually played music, which is, I know, bizarre. And you had all these different acts being played. It wasn't just one genre. It was all of it. And we loved it all. It was so amazing. It was such a cool time.
Yeah, there's a lot of diversity. I mean, I think about, like, one of my favorite bands from the 90s is L7. I'm going to see them October 15th at Metro. I kind of did some research on them because I was curious. And Susie and I, the guitarist, follow each other on Instagram. I don't know, maybe she thinks I'm funny or something. But I thought of them, they've never had a gold record. And I was like, really? And I think it was like, you know, they kind of got hit their stride now. Like, they record, I think, on Joan Jett's label. It probably cost them like a couple thousand bucks at most to do their records. They know they make their money on tour for people like me to go pay $65 to see them.
Sure.
But, you know, they weren't really played. Like, it was, I think, a cornerstone of grunge, but like the rock stations weren't playing them the way they were playing, like the Loop in Chicago here was playing Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. They weren't playing L7. I don't know why that was, but there was a lot of diversity. It almost kind of, the theme behind it was like, it wasn't really as concerning to, like, is this one of the top 20 bands? Or, like, have they sold a lot of records? It's like, you know, you would hear these songs by Marcy Playground or the Toadies or whatever. The scene had its one-hit wonders, if you want to call it that, but they weren't sugary poppy one-hit wonders that, you know, were about, you know, oh, do you love me, you know?
Right.
And women participated too. You can talk about the grunge thing being very masculine, but you had the Lilith tour. You had, you know, one of the biggest solo artists of the mid-90s was Alanis Morissette. She sold a ton, sure, ton of records, and, you know, she's still around. So that was cool to see all that.
And even within that kind of grunge scene, you know, you had Hole, you had Garbage, you had a number of those bands that were female acts that you looked at and said, they're huge.
Yeah.
We're blowing up. That was such an interesting time. And maybe it's L7 for you. Maybe that's the band. Is there a band from the 90s that you look at and say, why were they just not bigger? They were so talented. They were really good. Why did they not take off? I even think of a band like the New Radicals that I'm sitting there going, a couple of huge hits and fell off a cliff, like gone. You never even heard of them again. Was there a band out there for you that you were just like, man, why aren't they bigger?
I don't know. I think there's a couple. There's a band, kind of preceding the grunge scene, a band called the Connells from North Carolina.
Okay.
And they're kind of big in the college circuit. And it's in the same way that REM is, they have radio friendly tunes that aren't too poppy.
Sure.
And I always thought, well, but part of it, I think, was that their lead singer, like their front man looked like a woodshop teacher and he dressed like a woodshop teacher. It was like, you know, the management comes to me like, Doug McMillon, like he's got a great voice, but he looks like he just rolled out of bed.
Right.
And I know that their bass player, like the bass player's wife had cancer. And so I think that limited their ability to tour.
Okay.
There's some of that stuff that we don't think about in rock and roll where some artists don't have great administration skills and they just don't want to tour. Like to give you a stark example, like, people don't know this, but when Bob Marley was doing all the touring around the world in the U.S. and really making his footprint in the 70s, like Bunny Wailer stayed home. Peter Tosh left the band in 73. Even their like the musicians on the album, Al Anderson was the guitarist and he didn't want to tour. Actually, it worked out because Don Kinsey, who's a blues guitarist from Northwest Indiana, played on a lot of their tours. I mean, he was freaking awesome. Like you listen to Live at the Roxy. If anybody is kind of not an expert, but curious about Bob Marley, the live stuff is better. Listen to Live in the Roxy was recorded in 76. I want to say it didn't come out till like 2003. So then when it came on Spotify, I was like, it's here finally. Like When they finally put Dr. Dre's The Chronic, like what took so long? And I put it up, I just listened to the musicianship is great. There's a lot of that going on in bands. Like, you know, you think like was the original bass player in Soundgarden an idiot? Like, why didn't he stay in the band? I mean, Soundgarden became this big thing, but they have personal stuff that's going on. You know, the Descendants, luckily Milo could go back to college and grad school and keep his career and show up at Riot Fest and he's like a, you know, like a vice president of research at some biotech company. People have real lives in bands, and I think there's at least probably a dozen of them. I'm trying to, my mind's kind of stalling here, but like, you know, Dinosaur Jr., like a trio, they're really led by one guy, Jay Mascis. Their musicianship's great. I don't know why they weren't bigger, but they are well regarded, and like my 16-year-old likes them, and I'm taking him next Friday to see them. I texted him last week because the tickets were not that expensive. I was like, oh, keep next Friday open. We're going to Dinosaur Jr. And usually, like, I text my kid like, there's pizza in the fridge. Okay,
right.
We're gonna have lobster tonight for dinner. All right, that sounds fine. Like, I text him about Dinosaur Jr. He's like, oh my god, thank you. This is so awesome.
That's great.
How'd you know? So.
Well, speaking of those bands, there's also bands like that that you kind of feel like they left money on the table. If you would have pursued it, you could have been you could have had so much more. And I hate to even bring these up because they're obviously mainstream. How much money has Led Zeppelin left on the table? How much money did Guns N' Roses leave on the table? I mean, there's bands like that that just never could get it together or go.
I think that's a bad example, but like Tribe Called Quest, they kind of broke up in the middle of the late '90s and that. Okay, maybe the natural progression was they were going to go real pop and they're going to end up, you know, I mean, some people kind of think like, good then they broke up because they would end up being like the Black Eyed Peas. I don't know if I agree with that. But yeah, like they left a lot of money on the table just when like us, you know, I'll put it this way, like us suburban white kids who moved to the city who loved alternative rap, if we want to call it that, were like dying for them to tour some more. Like the one time they came to Chicago, House of Blues, I don't even remember. I know whatever the ticket price was, I was going to pay it. Three of us went. We were waiting there for 2 hours for them to come on. I think this is 98. They came actually, they all came out one at a time wearing white Blackhawks jerseys, which I thought was kind of funny because the Blackhawks sucked at the time.
Okay.
But, you know, it's like, yeah, they should have stuck together and they would have been like, they were just a step away from being huge. And There are a lot of bands like that. We could have a whole other segment, you know, a whole other episode talking for hours about that. But I don't know if I have any expert answers on that, but I am encouraged that when, you know, I went to see Slater Kinney in 2003 in October. And now, like, so they played Riot Fest. I went to Riot Fest on Saturday. I didn't go Sunday. But it is kind of comforting. It's annoying, but mostly comforting. Like, I can't get Slater Kinney tickets because they go on sale and they're gone like that. They're still around and they're respected in that. I don't know how many records they sold, but they're not considered like, oh, they're a 90s band and they kind of came and went. Like, they're doing what they want to do. And when they show up in town, they're diehards. You know, I kind of joke, it's like the, when the Cards come to town to play the Cubs, you can't get tickets because all the people from St. Louis come up.
Sure.
Because they're diehards about their team and they know that Chicago is a better city than St. Louis. So all the tickets are gone and you got to go watch it at a bar. And then the Cubs are going to get, you know, they're going to always get beat up by the Cards.
Right.
Yeah. Slater Kinney's fans are like that. And if most of them came because of Portlandia and Carey having a career on that, then so be it. You know, I guess I could say some before they were cool, but it's cool that they can still do what they're doing. And I'm glad that there are band like L7 is going to come and play pretty much a full house, and that those 90s bands that are still out there, maybe restarting their careers. You know, there's an open market and an audience that wants to hear them, and it's not brushed off as just like, oh, you know, the Culture. You know, like I remember when Culture Club was coming back in the late 90s.
Yeah.
I thought, like, who's going to see Culture Club? And a lot of my gay friends are like, I'm freaking going. Like, I've got 20 people I'm going with because,
sure,
you know, like I kind of like the music and I want to see Boy George's, you know, whatever hat he's wearing. And, you know, like that's like, I'm not going to not see Culture Club because I couldn't see him in the 80s. That was sort of the rationale. And now I'm sure he could come play City Winery and sell the house out, at least if not a bigger venue. So it's cool to see all that stuff going on, I think.
It's absolutely fascinating. And I could sit here and have this conversation with you all day, talk music, talk sports. I truly enjoyed listening to your insight. Let me ask you this, though. I won't take up much more of your time, but where can listeners find your book? Where can they find your work? Where can they follow what it is that you do? Are you out there on social media?
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter and Instagram is @SportyFry with an E on the end of Fry.
Okay.
As far as the book goes, I mean, if you're plugged into Amazon pretty tightly, I know a lot of people get everything from their, you know, their toilet paper and socks to their,
sure,
there. You know, you get, I mean, I'm sure there's some people who buy spark plugs there and put them in their cars themselves.
I bet they do.
You know, back in the day when we first heard about Amazon.com, you know, we typed it all out all the way. It was
right. A book. www.
Yeah. Right? They do still sell books. So you have 90 Days in the 90s, you can find it on Amazon or really any bookstore, online book place you find it. But if you want, you know, if you want a signed copy, you can go to my website, 90daysinthe90s.com. It's, you know, 90s with the number. It is cool that way because, you know, me, the artist, I get a little bit more money and a little bit less goes to Jeff Bezos.
He's got enough
cowboy hats. He got enough cowboy hats. He doesn't need more of my money. And I'll sign it for you and I'll send you some swag, like some stickers and bookmarks. And I've got a really cool bookmark that's shaped like a concert ticket.
It looks very cool.
Concert ticket back to the 90s. You know, it's got a QR code that'll take you back in time. But yeah, either the website or you know, just Amazon, just kind of depends. And if you're in Chicago, there are a couple of independent book and record stores like Reckless and Rattleback Records in Andersonville and the bookseller. I'm speaking there in October. They've got a couple copies of my book. So it just depends on where you go to get your books. But yeah, it's around.
Andy, I cannot thank you enough for the time. Cannot thank you enough for coming in. Spend some time on the Daily Dose. Really, really enjoyed your insight, enjoyed your information. Looking forward to reading the book myself. I might have to go to your site and get some of that swag myself because I'm fascinated by the whole thing. Very, very interesting stuff. Truly appreciate you coming in. You are welcome anytime.
Yeah, I got a question for you. So
absolutely. Actually, what do you got?
One of my favorite Denver bands is Dressy Bessie. If you're not familiar.
No, Dressy Bessie.
Yeah, I mean, I watched them during the pandemic. They did like every other week, they did like a basement concert. And sometimes it'd be just like two of them and like a couch behind them, and they would play a set for an hour.
Yeah.
Lots of fun. I've never seen them live. They came here. I think that the last time they came here was the night that Trump was supposed to speak at UIC Pavilion and whatever happened. He bailed. But
yeah,
some friends of mine went to Dress. I didn't even know they were in town. I was totally disappointed. So I've never got to see them, but I imagine they got to be in Denver playing at least like once a month or so. So like,
honestly, you know, it's funny. So we were supposed to go last night. I was going to take my daughter to go see her first, you know, real concert. We were going to go see the Gaslight Anthem.
Okay.
Brian Fallon got sick, lost his voice playing in Salt Lake City. So like shows at 7, Tiger's Jaw is going to open for him. And at 2:30, we got the notification. It's off. Not going to go. I guess he was trying to give it a go. Didn't have it. So I was like, oh, we were so, so bummed. So now we're sitting there saying, okay, who we're going to go see, because I still want her to go see, you know, go see her first show. Except my son has gone to Red Rocks. Obviously Red Rocks is a different animal. Really, really cool to see shows up there, but I'm like, okay, who do you want to go see? So we're trying to find someone for her to go see now. So maybe we're gonna have to look into that a little more. We were even looking at, you know, Nathaniel Ratliff or something like that and see if we could find, you know, a local band like that to see. So yeah, we're kind of on the hunt right now for someone.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'd be good, but you know Denver more than I do. There's tons of cool places to hang out. So
there are some really fun places. Denver has a kind of a quiet music scene because you won't you won't hear from them, and all of a sudden they're blowing up, and you're going, "Wow, really?" You didn't know, but yeah, we've seen that every once in a while. We'll see a band from Denver kind of take off. So yeah, Denver's an odd city. I'm born and raised here, but Denver's kind of an odd place in general. We're kind of this weird, we're turning into this weird California junior kind of situation, which is odd to me because I'm going back to where this is like, you know, Cowtown. So it's a little bit strange to me.
But, well, I love the street tacos in Denver. The fact that they're pretty much everywhere is pretty cool.
You can find really, really good food here. You can always find really good green chili here. Yeah, there are a few good spots. So if you're going to be in Denver, that you got to make sure and hit a few real good burger spots downtown. Go down Cherry Creek area, Boulder. Fort Collins has some sneaky places up there. It's a little quieter up there. But yeah,
like the whiskey with the E in parentheses. I've been there to see some like bluegrass, and
oh yeah,
I actually like drinking whiskey. So it's an underrated place for sure.
Absolutely. Andy, thank you so much for coming into the Dose. I genuinely appreciate your time, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, thanks. Good talking to you.
Hey, next week on The Dose, it has been a little while since we have fully checked in on both college football and the NFL. You know, we just might have to drill down on how that is all going, and we just might have some Daily Dose power rankings for you, so be sure you stop by The Daily Dose next week, and be sure you let a friend know to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you so much to author Andy Fry for stopping by and sharing some insight on your career with us. Be sure that you stop by andyfry.com and pick up your copy of 90 Days in the 90s and get some swag from Andy while you're there. Be sure you also go out and you follow Andy on social media at sportyfry.com as well. He's got a lot of things coming out that are very, very interesting. Hey, I also want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the email. Thank you for the text. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you so much for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.
Please refrain from using any further obscenities in the presence of these people.
What?
I've warned you. I'll be forced to thrash you.